No rate and review this week, huh?
Yeah.
We don't need your stupid reviews.
Because if they didn't like it,
make that the cold open.
No one takes you seriously, Colin.
That's because this is such a comic podcast.
Very true. Someone who's a professional sitcom writer listened to this podcast and said to me last week, "Hey, you guys are funny. So take that."
Hello and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Camel. I am the senior editor of the journal Ad Fontes, and I'm joined as always by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan Redimer, the poetry editor at Ad Fontes, and Reese Laverty, the editorial fellow. Oh, man, I just like reverted back 3 months.
Managing editor.
I manage. You manage.
Somehow I manage.
That's right. Well, and today we are very excited to be joined by Professor Patrick Downey, who is a colleague, actually, of Colin's at St. Mary's College in California. And Professor Downey is joining us today because, well, we're here to talk about the second edition of his book. The second edition...
All right, so we just, while he's answering that, we have to...
It's spam, I can't turn it off.
Okay, so listeners don't realize. Listeners don't realize what we've been through to get this episode on the road.
We've got a demon in the electronic systems.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah, we had 40 minutes of tech issues, but now here we are. Downey, it's good to have you with us.
I'm getting the cold call.
but we're very excited to talk about your book with you.
We were interrupted. It's the second edition.
I think you said the second edition of.
Yeah, it's the second edition of his book, Serious Comedy. I'm extremely excited to talk with you because back when we decided at Davenant to try to publish a second edition, I was still the editor in chief of the press. So Colin and I were chatting about it, and Colin's like, "Ansi, there's this great book, you know, by my friend. We've got to, like, you know, we got to publish a second edition." And you know, I'll admit, I was a little skeptical at first.
Skeptical.
The phrase vanity project may have popped into my head. But then Colin sent me the manuscript, and I read it. And I was like, this is amazing. We have to publish it. So, you know, from that point until today, we've been working, you know, very diligently, you know, different people at the press and Patrick himself. And it's been a really, really amazing process. So we're really excited to have this book coming out. Colin and Reese, why don't you guys, you know, take it from here? Because you've done a lot of the heavy lifting since I greenlighted the project. You guys have been working with Patrick very closely. So why don't you guys kind of take it away and we can go from there.
Sure. I mean, you know, the title's Serious Comedy, and the subtitle is The Philosophical and Theological Significance of Tragic and Comic Writing in the Western Tradition. And so I guess my first question is just going to be the softball that lets you sort of expand on this. Why serious comedy? You know, why not hilarious tragedy? Why not, why not funny comedy? I like funny comedies. What's behind the title, can you expand on how that connects in with the Western tradition and philosophy and theology? It's sort of like one of those subtitles that sounds like it's going to cover everything, and yet you manage it in 180 pages or 200 pages.
The book does kind of cover everything.
I couldn't stop myself. Yeah. The serious comedy, it's just the difference between life and writing that you see in Plato's Phaedrus. And so a life can be playful or serious, but also writing can be comic or tragic. But each is on a separate track. So can you relate the two? And so Plato would seem to say you live your life seriously, but that means you don't take your writing seriously. So you write comedies. But his criticism of the tragic poets is they take their writing very seriously, but that means they don't know how to live a serious life because they're lying to themselves. And so that becomes the quarrel that Plato has between the poets and the philosophers. So with the Christian thing, maybe there's a way that you could actually live your life seriously and have, so to speak, serious writing, but it wouldn't be tragic. It would actually be comic writing, but it would be serious in terms of your life lived relative to the writing. So that's okay. Kind of the unique possibility of the Christian tradition.
Can we back up a second and just can you kind of walk us through what you mean? Walk our listeners through what you mean, comedy, tragedy, because you're working out of you start with the Greek tradition, and the Greeks had like very sort of definite, you know, meanings for these terms. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of just walk us through that? And then maybe kind of explain again the tension that you see between the serious and the sort of silly, maybe, and then the tragic and the comic.
Yeah. Well, maybe the best way to do it is in terms of comedy and tragedy. So think of a stage. Okay. In a tragic stage, you're absorbed in what's on the stage, but you're in a darkened audience and you don't think about yourself. So mm-hmm. you kind of forget yourself and you look at what's produced on stage. So what's produced is made by a poet. So you're absorbed in the poem, and that's tragedy. But you forget yourself as the audience. Mm-hmm. But in a comedy, the poet will actually pull back the curtain and before the play starts, talk to the audience. And he'll say, I'm gonna give you a bunch of jokes here. This is gonna be a funny story. Some of you will get the good jokes, some of you will get the hard jokes, and so you'll divide up the audience, but I'm telling you what I'm gonna do. So now you in the audience, it's like the light is shown on you. Because you've broken that fourth wall and you're aware that you are now part of the play. Am I going to get the jokes? Am I not going to get the jokes? So in comedy, the audience becomes, in one sense, in a co-conspiracy with the poet.
The so classic example aware. Of this is like in Blazing Saddles, right? So, which is a hilarious comedy, Mel Brooks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's several moments where the set begins collapsing or sort of like right, people end up, you sort of see the cameramen sort of like, you know, wearing a tutu or something in the background and you sort of laugh about the fact that you're watching this thing. But if you think of like No Country for Old Men or There Will Be Blood, it would never work. You could never show the cameraman filming the like son going deaf or something. It would just completely break the spell.
And it holds true in like the way that you watch it, that, you know, when you're watching a comedy, you will turn to the people, even in the cinema, you'll turn to the people next to you and you have a joke that you both find really funny and you know, just crack up and it reminds you of somebody. Whereas in a tragedy, or you know, what we call a drama now, I guess, no, you don't want to be interrupted. You don't want someone to break your... And you made me think of actually my mother. I hate watching films with my mother because if you're watching something funny or an action comedy and somebody dies, she'll go, well, that's the end of him then. but she'll also do that in like the Green Mile or like Champ or something like that. You know, it just breaks everything.
That breaks the spell.
And so, but here's a question for you. So in antiquity, they would have all been tragoedia, right? So they're all tragedies. But then some of the tragedies are comedies, and some of the tragedies are what we would call tragic. So are you making a distinction? Are you making that distinction, or are you making some other distinction? At what point does comedy sort of enter into the tragic?
I'd say for the Greeks, it basically is tragedies, except for Aristophanes, and that's comedy. It's just like Blazing Saddles. So he's Saddles for the day.
Tragedy just meant like the theater. Tragedy initially.
Well, no, but yeah, the Dionysia had both comedies and tragedies. Mm-hmm. But when Plato criticizes poets, he has in mind primarily tragic poets.
Right. Agathon. So my question is he the first person to use tragedy in that sense? Because it seems like there's a development of what's meant by tragedy there, like etymologically.
The tragedy is kind of the goat story that Aristotle talks about. And so it's a goat story because there is this kind of violent quality. It's tied in with scapegoating. And so that becomes the running with that as one end of the spectrum. But then you have comedy back then. And so he's always two or three times he says, well, if you're going to write, would you be able to write just tragedies or also write comedies? And he says a philosopher should be able to do both. But the implication is you got to do one or the other unless you're a philosopher. Mm-hmm. So you have at the end of the symposium, he's with a comic poet, Aristophanes. He's with a tragic poet, Agathon. And they're talking because they're drunker than everybody else, but they're still sober. And then finally, the comic poet falls asleep. The tragic poet falls asleep. Socrates is totally sober and awake, even though he's been drinking all night. He walks away because he's transcended both of those. But those seem to be the two options. So how do you relate to one of those two options? So whether they're really that opposed on the stage in ancient Greece, in Plato's mind, he wants you to see them as two fundamental options, comic poetry or tragic poetry. And how do you relate to both of them as a philosopher or in terms of your own life?
Hmm. Okay.
And so, that's... so they're more than the actual things you see on stage. There's some about your relationship to your life itself and how you relate to books and things that are written to this imaginative world.
So why is it that the pagans couldn't believe in tragedy? So you sort of they can't take tragedy seriously. It seems like if you're not a Christian, you know, you, and this is something Anzi and I are always arguing about, if you're not a Christian, you could sort of believe that death is the end and that it's all winding down and you could sort of take tragedy seriously. Why is that not a possible from their perspective, right? As opposed to, I can understand why you would make the move and say, well, theologically, because we believe Christianity is true, the pagans can't really take this seriously because they're not in touch with reality.
Well, I'm not sure I get your premise. I would argue that the ancients took tragedy seriously. The Greeks, you know, that their whole religion is basically a tragic religion. They took that seriously, but that meant they forgot themselves. The thing is, once Christianity's on the scene, and to a lesser extent, Platonic philosophy, now we can't take tragedy seriously. We're Reese's mom. Because we're in this modern world, no matter how serious the movie is, somebody can pipe up and say, oh, you know, well, there he goes, he's gone. And then suddenly this spell's broken and you can't take it seriously, which means you have a hard time taking your life seriously, too.
The thread I wanted to pull on is that Plato seems to see through it.
Plato does, yeah. But he's kind of along with, I think, Christianity between those two. Now the joke is always there, ready to be sprung on any tragic narrative. The spell has been dispelled. In other words, the enchantment of tragedy is you forget yourself and absorb in this deadly experience, but somehow it's a release from it. But now the release can't happen. The spell doesn't work. The enchantment doesn't work of tragedy.
And you talk a fair bit, Patrick, in the book about... It's not just about kind of, oh, what is Culture X's attitude towards literature, but actually for the ancients, those tragedies that are kind of the shared narratives, the popular stories of theirs, kind of have this foundational role in societies. Girard and scapegoating and that kind of thing. And it's important in tragedy that the hand of the poet is kind of hidden.
Right.
And that it's taken in some sense as being real, because that allows society to kind of have that, you know, that story at the rock bottom of everything, and then you can build a stable society on the back of that story, which was fantastic to see that pulled apart in the book. I'll leap forward to something contemporary. Do we have those now, or those kind of foundational stories? I guess, you know, Christ has been the scapegoat at the foundation of Western society for however long anyone wants to say that for. As we're drifting away from the serious comedy of Christianity being at the bottom of everything, have we replaced it with tragedy? Are we just all kind of detached and comic, like My Poor Mother?
The latter's the thing that's happened. I mean, that's what Nietzsche diagnoses. The last man laughs at everything. Everything's funny. It's all a Seinfeld episode. It's a show about nothing, and we know it's a show about nothing. And so that's the nihilism of this hyper-comic mode we're in. So even when we take seriously The Green Mile or some movie that we take, you know, is profound, we still walk out of the theater and know we're just kind of fooling ourselves. We really can't hide that hand. We kind of know it's a lie. It's for entertainment's sake. It really isn't reality we saw there.
And so in Patrick... in the way that kind of pop culture eats itself now.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The great... So like, I think about the Ghostbusters... recent sequel, not the all women one, but the one with the members of the original cast in.
There's another one with the original cast in it.
And there's going to be another one.
It's apparently very serious. They take themselves very seriously.
Yeah, and that's it. Yeah, it's really, and it's kind of meta because it's just like eating into the feeling that it's like Stranger Things. It's eating into the feeling that you had in the 80s watching it. And I know someone said once, I think it's a maybe Notes from the Screenplay, which is a YouTube video essay guy, said how every film is about something, apart from Ghostbusters, which is about nothing.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And now we've got this deadly serious kind of eating itself sequel about it, and we're having to put that at the basis of our kind of sense of, you know, wonder. And,
so, Patrick, you were saying that, you know, now we can't take tragedy seriously, right? There's a sense in which we recognize that it's kind of an illusion, it's a spell. I mean, you can even see this in St. Augustine's writings, you know, when he writes about the plays, you know, the theater and so on. He thinks it's very dangerous, but he clearly recognizes that it's unreal, right? That there's something sort of fictive about what's happening. So we don't take tragedy seriously. We also, I mean, if I'm understanding how these two tracks are working, comedy seems inherently unserious, right? I mean, the sort of point of comedy is that we're sort of all in on the joke together. So then what's serious about comedy with Christianity? Well, how does Christianity make that serious?
Yeah, so take the example of the poet breaking the fourth wall. He's basically saying, I'm trying to please you, and that's when you laugh, you're pleased, and I'm going to be happy. Okay, so, but we know he's trying to please us, so we know it's a game that we're in on, and we're going to take advantage of this, but we know it's phony, because it's not natural, it's not the real world, it's the artificial world. But if that poet that says, I'm trying to make you happy, I'm the one that created all of reality, and I also created this poem, now you could take it seriously because of the nature of the poet. So if and only God is the comic poet, can you take it seriously? If it's any other human being that made this poem, you know it's two human beings faking themselves out for entertainment value or to give themselves an artificial pleasure. But if it's God himself that made this comedy, and he gives you a happy ending, he didn't just give this fake thing to you, he gave you reality with that happy ending. So that's the whole claim of God, is the poet of Scripture and the resurrection. He's the one that can really have a happy ending.
But he's the only true author. He's the only true author.
And that's why if you move into an atheistic age, after which Christianity has already broadly been, you know, imbibed by the culture, you're going to have people, like you said, that's how you end up where Reese is talking about, where everybody's doing comedy because comedy is clearly sort of superior and it's what we really believe in. But we don't really believe in it because there's no comic author that we can trust.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And yet, you know, I thought of my mother as I read this book. Yet I also thought of kind of, I don't know, maybe myself for a bit at the age of 17, where like, you know, the really serious movies that I was watching gave an immense amount of sense and foundation to the world. And actually... You talk. I think it's in the new intro that you've written for this edition, Patrick. About we live out of our books, we live out of our stories. So I wonder if it. I don't know. Are we bifurcating down two tracks again, where we have people who everything's comic, Nietzsche, The Last Man Laughs, and then some people who actually are going in so hard on their stories at the bottom of everything. And I wonder if it's in an age where actually real life. Is so performative, actually kind of real tragedies, which are turned into kind of artificial narratives, can kind of become the tragic stories that people base themselves on. Like, and I'll take a not a super tragic example, but like the Johnny Depp Amber Heard saga, which Patrick, you may know nothing about, and good for you. That's the game. But like, a lot of people, Gen Z kids included, like, put a lot of their stake on this kind of, you know, rolling news story, which has also become a social media thing.
And that's what, in the new intro, I mentioned the Underground Man, because he looks at that, the young, earnest 17-year-old that reads certain books and certain movies, really, this matters, this is important. Okay, but the problem is he's cynical and he knows, and the smarter people kind of figure this out. That's really pathetic. And so, but if you take it seriously, you don't notice how pathetic you are. But there's always somebody saying, that's pathetic. Give me a break. You're just fooling yourself. And so you can't afford to be conscious about how you're faking yourself out, because it'll ruin, the spell you're putting on yourself. But the way to do that is just to be silly and non-reflective. And so then you got to be silly and non-reflective to take your life seriously. But, you know, if you're serious and reflective, you want to have a real way that you can do that. You can't just fake yourself out. It only works for so long.
That's a kind of interesting observation to reflect on in the context of the kind of, how to put it, the sort of adopted posture of most people on social media, right? This kind this tone of like, incessant irony, right? Everything's ironic. Nothing is taken seriously.
Right,
we all sort of... you know, post on social media or record ourselves on TikTok with a smirk on our face, because we that, you know, no one's going to get the, you know, the joke's not on me, the joke is on life, or, you know, these postures that we take toward the world.
There's also a very serious strain on social media as well, right? So you have people who, you know, we could call them social justice warriors or something, who are like, no, like, we really have to get these people off. Like, this is like high stakes, is like whether or not so-and-so is allowed to say these things on Twitter. You know, that person has to, we've got to cancel them. I mean, they've got to, I kind of feel like cancellation is the logical endpoint of some of what you're writing about and some of the sort of Girardian things that you're drawing on, because it's like the fakest form of scapegoating and sacrificing of the scapegoat to found your regime ever existed. It's like you're not even really sacrificing them. You're just like kicking them off of a Twitter platform.
It never works, though. So they furiously do this. They furiously, you're the bad people. But at the end of the day, you know, that just didn't work. They got to move on to something else.
But see, doesn't that sort of inspire in you guys a bit of like pity? I mean, because it's a desperate attempt to live a serious life, right? I mean, like the sort of impulse behind the person who wants someone else deplatformed is the impulse is one in which the person who's calling for the cancellation wants there to be moral stakes, like real moral stakes, and they want to be able to participate in a life in which there are you know, not only moral truths, but in which their sort of actions have the capacity to act in the world in such a way as to, like, realize that those stakes, right? And so, I mean, now, of course, it's amusing because of how it's happening, right? I mean, they're trying to do this on social media, you know, and so on. But but to me, that's kind of it's kind of sad, right? I mean,
I think maybe this is getting at what I was maybe trying to get at in the last question I asked, that because those cancellations are, you know, public lynchings, are in fact not public lynchings, they're just carried out over social media, someone's life is actually ruined often. But as far as the people piling on are concerned, it's just a story. You know, every public cancellation is just Oedipus Rex or Othello or whatever, just acted out again, the individual... Patrick,
it's Harry Potter or Star Wars race.
Those are the frameworks. Right. Patrick talks about kind of being disintegrated or that's not the right word. But, you know, you're, in a comedy, everyone's integrated into society at the end, or the hero is, and in a tragedy, they are disintegrated, or, you know, they're cut off on their own.
I mean, but all our tragedies don't actually do it. That, you know, that's even you saying, well, these people's lives are ruined. It's like, I mean. Yeah. No, their lives generally aren't ruined. They sort of like lose a job and then they go get another job.
So you, now that's the modernity has had this problem. Intellectually, this is going on with Nietzsche and Hegel and all these guys. They really want something to be taken seriously. They want real bloodshed and violence that's going to work, but it never does. And so finally, that's why Nietzsche has the last word. Yeah, this is really a joke. It's not going to work. But yeah, somehow I'm the one that can pull it off. I could pronounce holy my laughter. He's just desperate to somehow transform comedy, this corrosive comedy, and make it now finally stick and last. And so he's got to finally advocate violence, but he still does it kind of comically. He can't do real violence. He doesn't kill anybody. He just kills people with words.
I want to try to sort of, let's bring tragedy back for a minute, because I want to defend tragedy from you.
You just told me you were starting to read Augustine. I had such high hopes for your intellectual trajectory now that you're working on Augustine.
He got to the bit where Augustine talks about, you know, how some people love to feel sad, and Colin thought, yeah, I love to feel sad.
Yeah.
I'm going to go feel sad now.
It feels so sweet, yeah.
just to see how the argument works, right? Somebody has to sort of take the position. So why not, you know, Stalin didn't kill enough people. That's the problem, Patrick. What we need is a you know, some sort of like nuclear exchange with Russia, which could help us to sort of recognize the seriousness of reality again. And if we would just launch the nukes and sort of take one for the team, then whoever lives through this is going to know what reality is really about. Yeah. You know, won't that work, Patrick?
Well, that's nothing new. That's exactly what everybody was thinking when they marched off to war in 1914. The Germans, the English, the French, they thought that this war is going to give meaning to our lives that we didn't have prior to the war, when life is good and sweet but bourgeois and we hated it. Now if we kill each other, we will be warriors that have meaning. And everybody was thinking that. And of course it became a joke. Everybody knew it right away. It just became bloodshed. So you're just redoing the same sort of thing. They're trying to have the effects of tragedy, but they can't believe it. They know it's a lie. They know that they are deluding themselves. So they'll frenziedly maybe have a nuclear exchange next time, but it's going to be the same inevitable lack of tragic result.
And when you say deluding themselves, just to clarify, do you mean they know that ultimately the stakes are meaningless? That which is why, like, in the aftermath of World War One, you see this kind of like, you know, extreme disillusionment settle in, right? Because it's even the sort of most ultimate act that a human society can take, which is war, you know, ultimately like bottoms out in nothingness. It's just sort of
The catharsis doesn't happen.
Right.
For the Greeks, the catharsis happened. You walked out of the theater, you were purged. But at the end of World War One, or even after, you know, August was over, nobody was purged. No purgation took place. You never kind of had this unity afterwards. It used to have the unified tragic audience. The fragmentation continued, and everybody became more and more individualized, as happens in comedy. But so, the whole thing was to make us all come together, and we're unified. We have something we all believe in that's bigger than us. That never happens.
So again, I mean, I think the Nietzschean, the Nietzschean would say we didn't kill enough people, so we didn't. It was sort of like they tried, but they sucked at it, and that's why it didn't work. And I think here's the philosophical question underneath the sort of extremity of the Nietzschean sort of position on the sociology and anthropology or whatever, like, let's kill a lot of people. So I think the philosophical question underneath it would be to ask you, is the change that the Christian comedy has brought into reality ontological, or is it just sort of a fact of the text, right, of history? So if we nuked enough people, it's not just that we kill enough people, but what if we could, like, wipe out the historical record? You know, you only have a few dozen people who make it through the nuclear Holocaust. You know, those people don't have access to the text. Eventually they can kind of forget about Christianity. And then maybe you could return to a position like the Greeks were in, where tragedy sort of has this effect on them.
Well, that's what you see in the Canticle of Leibowitz. You know, the world blows itself up in the Holocaust, few survive, but then the same thing's going to happen again and again, because it's the eternal recurrence of the same, which tragedy yields. Tragedy can never end. You just end up doing it again. It's like a religious ritual. You got to do it once a year. Mm-hmm. But then a year later, you got to do it again. So tragedy has to repeat this over and over again, because there's no way you can actually come to an end. It can never be fulfilled. You have to repeat. So that's what Nietzsche's trying to do, the eternal recurrence of the same.
Right.
If I could become a god, I could make this eternal repetition something that becomes stable, if I were a god. Well, he's not a god. And so then that's why the Christian says, yeah, God is the only one that really can do this, but he is not the one that kills. He's the one who's killed. And by God being killed, he can actually make this eternal in a way that Nietzsche can't do it because of who he is. He is the one that made the world. He can be killed in such a way that his death is a once and for all sacrifice that puts an end to all future sacrifices. There's no need for it anymore.
So does Christianity expose this ontological situation, or does it create or change the ontological situation of humans in history?
Well, it uncovers the lie. So you know it's a lie. You're fooling yourself. Okay, so then you can't fool yourself anymore. Okay, but it not only uncovers the lie, it also says, and this is why you're lying, because you're missing the point of what you really want. So before you can see with new eyes, you got to realize you're blind. Once you know you're blind, then there's something to see.
And so does when that happens, we see there's something to see. How does the serious comedy of Christianity alter the way that we then go back to these texts and these stories, which may be Christian, may come from within a broader Christian culture, or even how, you know, I go back to Plato and Aristotle and Aristophanes and whoever. Am I like Augustine, where I'm inherently suspicious of these things and, you know, think they're probably best left alone? Or does the serious comedy kind of enable me to take those things for what they are, be they tragedy or comedy?
Yeah, well, you can see them for what they are, but you're also aware that literature's in one sense, more of a threat to you in the Christian context than you'd. In other words, Dante's playing with dynamite when he kind of reproduces this and makes himself the main character in his poem. Because, yeah, God can be the main character in his poem because he's God. But when a human being takes on that role, it's very, very dangerous. Because, and so that's a lot of romantic literature is trying to become the God in our poetry. Because narratives, literature are not something you just play around with. They're serious stuff, dangerous stuff.
So are you saying that, like, the pagans were in they kind of lived in a naive sort of age in which they sort of, they don't recognize that the only, you know, true main character in the poem can be God, because he's the only one who can make, you know, he's the only one who can, you know, it's worth pointing out to our listeners that the Greek root of the word make and poetry is it's the same word.
Right.
So the poets are the makers. Mm-hmm.
And I think we can see the naivete because Plato is, I think, one of the first people who really does a lot of philosophical reflection on this issue. There's sort of an invention that happens with him, mm-hmm. which I think goes back to what you're saying earlier, why he's mm-hmm. sort of like the Christians in seeing through what the tragic is doing for the people.
Right. Whereas even Aristotle, people view Aristotle as, oh, he's just describing how tragedy works. It isn't that great. But Plato's the guy that realizes, and I think Aristotle knows this as well, that, yeah, this is serious, dangerous stuff. It's a lie. And if you want the truth, you got to be very aware of the nature of lies. Of course, if you don't want the truth, who cares? But Augustine, going back to Reed's question, Augustine's the guy that he knows how powerful narratives are, and yet he can't help but write a story of his own life, the Confessions. But he could do that because he knows everything I say is really confessing that main story, the only story that matters, and my story is just a recapitulation of that story. So everything important is a recapitulation of that serious comedy. And I am that character in that comedy. I have to retell that story all the time. And that's the nature of the liturgy. Every liturgical mass is just recapitulating the story and bringing you in. You got to keep telling that story and see who you are relative to that story. No other narrative can compete with that.
Yeah, I was just talking with my son last night about this, and because we're reading Harry Potter, and, you know, mm-hmm. there's a point in one of the books where it's like Harry Potter's battling Voldemort, like happens in all the books, and of course, you know, it's really tensely, it's tensely written, and yet my mm-hmm. son has done a lot of reading, even though he's relatively young, and so he knows that Harry Potter's not going to lose, because I explained to him what plot armor was. It's like, he has plot armor. And then I said, okay, well, do you have plot armor, Leaf? Mm-hmm. And he sort of had to think about it for a second, and he said, I don't think so. And I said, that's right. And why is that? And he was like, well, it's because I'm not the main character, right? Because who's the main character of the story? The main character is God. Yeah, okay, but and this is the strange twist of fate, right? This is the good news of the gospel, is that through Christ and through faith in Christ, you actually do get to participate in his plot armor.
So
it's like my story is a real part of the story, but it's a real part of the story because the story is real, because the author showed up and made it real.
Colin and Patrick, the way that you both just put that actually kind of helps me draw together some lines from Augustine, some lines of my own thinking, you know. So in thinking about in writing about Augustine on sex and the passions, it's very clear that Augustine thinks that every sexual act is a recapitulation of the disintegration of the fall, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's this sense in which all human acts, and sex is the paradigm case for Augustine, but all human acts are either participations in Adam's primordial act, or the participations in the new life that Christ gives, in Christ's sort of humility, right? So, and this is the Eucharist kind of is the ultimate habituation into Christ's humility, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a really interesting way of putting it, there's a kind of like, there's a false story for Augustine, which is Adam's story, but it's the story that we're all sort of born into and think that we're living out, right? In which we are the main character. In which our sort of original pride against God leads us to rebel, and we're the protagonist. And then,
my choices, I can become like God.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And you
I
should
just
be as God.
Enough people.
That's exactly. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, right. And so, but what Augustine has to realize is that story is ultimately false, and he has to be integrated into the Christian story, and so his actions become a sort of participation and recapitulation of that story.
Well, and Anza, well, to make that more concrete relative to the confessions, it literally is bound by two trees. Going back to the Garden of Eden, when he steals from the pear trees earlier on, he writes the story against the backdrop of being Adam eating the apple, and then later on, when he goes down behind the lays himself down at the tree in Milan. Now he is put, that tree is the cross.
Yeah.
And so he organizes the whole book in terms of the Garden of Gethsemane and the Garden of Eden. So he knows exactly that he has to plot his life against those two.
And a friend of mine who, honestly, I think he was referring to a paper on Augustine and sex that he wrote a while back, and a friend of mine used that as the basis for a sermon on sex, kind of question of, is there ever such a thing as, you know, good sex, you know, unselfish sex, I think, just kind of taking it from that angle. And he said, well, Augustine says, you know, all sex recapitulates the fall, but actually, that's all bad sex does that. All good sex actually recapitulates the gospel, because it's an act of self-sacrifice, and, you know, has inescapably the unique contours of male and female, and the different things they bring to that relationship.
You know, someone may ask, is there really good sex? But, you know, of course, that's the marriage. The marriage feast of the Lamb is good sex. And that was consummated in the Garden of Gethsemane. You have it, the first Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, but the second Adam and Eve is his own body, his bride, and he, the husband. And when he obeys his father, now that is a shareable marriage feast, the shareable sexual act that everybody can partake of is the relationship to his own body.
And we partake of it through the church, is that right?
What, I'm sorry?
We partake of it through the church.
Exactly, yeah. We're all married. We're all the brides of Christ, whether male or female.
Taking us back to literature, it's a book of philosophy, really. I think, you know, you mainly engage, Patrick, with philosophers, and the engagements with actual literary texts are kind of brought in as and when needed. So with the entry of the Christian gospel into history, do you think, and we talked about Augustine, that takes us up to antiquity. Sorry if you can hear my children in the background. Do you think there's a time in history, we talk about the post-Christian now, so we've got a big gap between Augustine and, let's say, the 20th century that we've not touched on too much. Is there a time where you think the church, or, you know, the Christian West, Christendom, gets its orientation to these things right? Is, you know, like Shakespeare, for example, is that? Is he the guy who gets tragedy and comedy correct?
Yeah, I'd say Shakespeare does, but I think Dante doesn't. In other words, Romanticism takes over, and that was the result of Dante.
So why? What's wrong with Dante, Patrick? Because so Patrick and I first met at last year's, not this year's Convivium, but last year's Convivium, and Patrick was at that Convivium an iconoclast in the best sense. He kind of came in and starts, you know, tearing at Dante. And, you know, Dante's pretty popular these days. He's had something of a revival in kind of scholarly circles, and then, you know, in popular circles, like I think Rod Dreher's written a book about him. And so, Dante this and Dante that, and Patrick just comes in and he just starts going after him. So, Patrick, why do you think that Dante kind of gives us idolatrous romantic poetry? What's going on there?
Well, I kind of touched on it before, because who's the main character of Dante's comedy? The poet himself. So the poet is the main character. Well, where do you get that idea? Because you don't see that in Homer or Virgil or any other major works. Well, he got the idea from Christianity. But the problem is, take for example, when he shows up in hell, these gates were made from eternity by the God that made everything. Well, who made those gates? If you're aware that it's a work of literature, Dante himself made those gates.
Right, but the gates aren't actually in Scripture.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and yet we live in Dante's world because we imagine that what hell is like. And so that's how powerful that is, that he now has become the architect of our world rather than Scripture being the architect of our world. So you have a parallel architecture. Whose world are you living in? Dante's? Or are you living in the Scriptures world? I don't have children, but I got phones.
Oh, my goodness. We're living in Mark Zuckerberg's world or something. It's a hellscape. That's good. And there's that moment. Is it at the end of the Purgatorio? When when is Dante crowned?
The end of Oratorio.
Crowned and mitered himself, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's the, you kind of took that as kind of emblematic of like Dante's sort of conscious that this is what he's doing. And you sort of see that at the end of the Purgatorio.
And notice that's what Napoleon does. When Napoleon becomes emperor, the ultimate paragon of modernity, he crowns himself rather than being crowned by the Pope. He's recapitulating what Dante does. And that's where Dante leads. He leads to Romanticism. And Romanticism is where humans want to become their own gods. They want to make their own story and live in the story they've made. That's what the little 17-year-old kid is doing. He's trying to make his own unique story and live in it.
And that's what Nietzsche's talking about in The Rebirth of Tragedy, right? Is like, if I could just launch all the nukes and I could kind of live through it somehow, I would be the one who's remaking reality and sort of getting rid of this god who's sort of messed things up by bringing comedy into things. Because I could then tell everybody the myth that, you know, about how great I was for destroying the world, and great, at least in the sense of scary, right? Yeah, that you should really fear me. I'm the one that's behind whatever's going on in your life. So Romanticism is sort of shot through all the way from Dante into Nietzsche and then beyond.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Whether he intended that or not, I think Romantics go back to Dante and he gives them their license. He gives them kind of borrowed seriousness that doesn't challenge them the way Scripture challenges you. Because Scripture says, this is God and you're not God. Dante, well, maybe I am God. He makes that a live possibility.
Well, here's the counter-argument, because I love a good argument. So isn't
Colin,
Moses...
you're just an argumentative dude. You're just a fractious...
He's a sophist.
isn't Moses a character in the Pentateuch? You know, I think you see very... Like, Peter writes some books of Scripture, but there he is wandering around with Jesus, you know, and... Yeah. Writing about his own church, Paul's writing about his exploits. So, how is that not a problem?
Colin, I mean, if you look at the Gospels, the self-presentation of the apostles is clearly not flattering throughout the Gospels. Clearly not the protagonists of the story, right? They're the sort of faithless, bumbling fools, right? And it's Christ who's constantly
less clear with Moses.
Well, there's this passage goes directly to that, Colin, and the Mount of Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah show up with Jesus, and then God says, this is my son, hear him, and they disappear, and only Jesus remains. It's telling you how to read the story relative to Jesus as opposed to Moses and Elijah. They disappear, Christ is the only thing that remains, because they have no life apart from him. So even though they precede him, he's the one that is prior to them. Same with John the Baptist. Even though he comes before Jesus, that he who comes after me is greater than I and was before me. So you have to have that relationship of true priority, and it's a vertical priority that overcomes any horizontal priority. So that's why Moses is not important, and he knows it.
And Patrick, in the Bible section of the book, because it's kind of divided into three, the ancients, the arrival of the Bible, and Hegel, Nietzsche, Kierkegaard at the end. You talk a lot about the narrator, the significance of the narrator when it comes to the Bible. So yes, we may say Moses is a significant character. He is even, you know, arguably a narrator as the author of the Pentateuch and especially Deuteronomy, although there are clearly other voices in there because we have the death of Moses recorded. But, you know, if we're taking the Bible seriously as actually what it claims to be, then that problem is kind of resolved because there is a capital N narrator of the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that would be my primary counter argument to my own argument, which would be to say, maybe you could make the argument that something like what Dante is up to is happening in some given book. But the point of having the Bible of the variety of books is that if you take them in aggregate, it's obvious that God is the centerpiece of the whole thing. He's the main actor. Right. He's the one who's doing whatever is happening. Whereas in Dante, if you read, and so this is to your point, Patrick, if you read, you know, the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the Paradiso, God is really at the margins. He's sort of like some things happened or whatever, but you never really see him. He never shows up. He doesn't really do anything or whatever he's doing is sort of passive. It's almost like nature, right? The way that the Stoics talk about nature, just kind of like it's there kind of stirring things up.
Yeah. And so just the opposite is the prologue of Gospel of John. So you have the Word creates everything outside, but then becomes flesh and dwells among us in the center of the story. So you go from the margins of the whole to the center of the thing. And so Lewis has that image of an author showing up in his own novel. And that's exactly how the prologue Gospel of John sets up the Bible. You have to see the whole novel, But then the author that can make the novel a novel is the main character and focalizes it. Mm-hmm. And that's quintessentially comic. Mm-hmm. And Dante is just an imitation of that.
Hmm. But that's not great. A fruitful imitation the way Augustine was, a sort of a negative imitation.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Augustine knew how to fruitfully
imitate it. An idolatrous imitation.
Yeah, well, possibly, yeah. And judging him by his fruits, I'd say yes. Yeah.
I'm just poking our listeners.
I did not expect to come out of a Christian conversation about literature with like hot takes against Dante. You know?
See, Reece, this is why I wanted. I'm glad Patrick started talking about Dante because I wanted to push him here because he's like the only one I've heard give that take, and I think it's a really interesting one. So I wanted to let him talk about that. So I think in the interest of time, we should start moving on to the next segment, which is the what we're reading segment. So Patrick, you're our guest today. So I want to ask you first, what have you been reading these days? What are you finding interesting?
I've been reading Leon Cass's commentary on Exodus and Genesis.
I've heard very good things about that. Have you been enjoying it?
I've been enjoying it, but I think he's fundamentally misguided,
okay.
But still stimulating.
Okay.
So and so just figuring out why he's misguided and what he gets right and what he gets wrong is fruitful for my own thinking on the subject.
Do you have any hunches?
Oh yeah, I think he misunderstands the first creation story, and then his account of Adam and Eve is anthropological. So he's basically Rousseau. He has a Rousseauian reading of the Genesis story. He thinks Genesis is what Rousseau's arguing, and what Rousseau's arguing is what Genesis is saying. And I think he's just wrong on both counts. But that shows how persuasive and powerful Rousseau was. That even now Leon Cass basically recapitulates his arguments, but these are not Christian arguments. Rousseau knew he was trying to replace Christianity, the Christian faith is an alternative. Whereas I think Leon Cass just falls for the fake version.
That's interesting.
But it brings back the real version. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. As opposed to the real. That's good. Reese, what are you reading these days?
I've been reading a few stanzas at a time to kind of lull myself to sleep. The whole of Tennyson's In Memoriam, A.H.H., which is his great elegy of grief. Very, I can't remember how many stanzas it is. You know, my page is folded currently at stanza 61, and I've got a long way to go. But it's a very melancholic, soothing way to fall asleep. And I don't really know Tennyson that well. Other than like, you know, this is the famous poem, to better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. You know, he pulls in these fantastic Christian, you know, broadly Christian at least, meditations about Lazarus coming back from the dead and there being no record of him talking about what it was like to die. And this being this kind of thing for Tennyson as the grieving friend about having no idea what the one he's lost has gone to beyond the grave. That's stanza 31, if anyone wants to go look it up. It's just been a little way of ending my day and trying to get kind of draw a line under the day and go to sleep. Think about death.
Yeah, Rice, I've actually heard this in my Victorian literature class, that in Victorian England, the two books you'd find almost on every bed table was the Bible and Tennyson's In Memoriam.
It's one of those that has this huge reputation. I'm sure at some point everybody had read it, or at least everybody wanted everyone to think they had read it. That's not the case anymore.
That's great. All right, Colin, what are you reading?
Besides the ever-growing pile of Aristotle and Aristotelian secondary literature.
No one wants to hear about Aristotle.
At this point in my dissertation, I would love to spend a year not thinking about Aristotle. I've got a lot to write and a lot less to read than I had a year ago, which is nice. It's sort of like you can tell when you've crossed the hump and you're like, okay, I know the stuff. I just have to sort of spit it out. But I've been doing some other reading on Cotton Mather, who's an American Puritan sort of, he's in the founding generation, if you don't want to call him a founding father. And in particular, he was famous for these sermons that he would give. There was like a genre of execution sermons. So you would, a pastor would go visit this condemned and preach them, and then they would often like walk with them to the gallows. And in colonial America, a lot of the execution sermons, the most kind of salacious ones, the most exciting ones, were about with pirates, because it was the golden age of piracy. A lot of people don't remember. Sort of coincides with the American colonial period. And so there's this great sermon called A Vial Poured Out Upon the Sea, which is the sermon that he preached to William Fly, who was like the most defiant pirate in the history of Boston, you know, and he basically doesn't repent. And it's his sermon and his account of how the hanging went at the end, which is fun. Huh. It's a good break from studying Aristotle.
Yeah, that's wild. That's wild. Well, that's great. Well, for my own part, I've been reading Johannes Zachuber. I hope I'm getting his name right. His new book, The Rise of Christian Theology and the End of Ancient Metaphysics, Patristic Philosophy from the Cappadocian Fathers to John of Damascus. And really, really, really fantastic book. I know Reese has been reading it as well. And we
I said yes, massive. In terms of, it's actually not that long, it's very dense, but it's a huge like contribution. I'm vastly underqualified to talk or write about it, although I have written about it for the upcoming Advantes, but it's it's a crazy significant work, it seems.
Yeah, just really phenomenal, and elucidates so many issues so clearly, particularly regarding like how after the articulation of the Nicene Creed and the sort of Nicene articulation of the Trinity, the Cappadocians develop a kind of, some of them think they're developing a grammar, really, more than a metaphysics, but a kind of like rules of speech about the Trinity. And then that gets sort of, that becomes over time a kind of metaphysics that undergirds the doctrine of the Trinity. And then Zachuber sort of demonstrates how this metaphysics, which was so useful in our articulation of Trinitarian dogma, tries to get pressed into service in our articulation of Christological dogma, and it's just not well suited for it. And so then, you know, after the Council of Chalcedon, you know, all these theologians are trying to rejigger their metaphysics to have a sort of unified model for both the Trinity and the person of Christ. So it's really, really remarkable work, I have to say. I've been very impressed with it. So, and with that, Reese, what are we spotlighting today?
Well, today we should spotlight Serious Comedy. So we're recording this a bit in advance, but this should come out just after the book's publication. So, it will be available on davenantinstitute.org, Serious Comedy, or on Amazon, wherever you are in the world. $34.95 of your Yankee dollars, and then whatever relative cost it is wherever you are in the world. Which, you know, I think Patrick said is about a third of what it cost when it was first printed. Done a service to the world and the church in redoing it. And I've, like Auntie said, I've done a lot of the Colin's asking me where do we buy it in the chat. I said from Amazon or from the Davenant website, which will just take you to Amazon. I think I said that. But I've done. I've ended up having to do the proofing for the book actually, which has meant I've got to give it a very thorough read, and it's fantastic. You know, if anything what we've said today tickles your fancy, then just go and get it, and you won't regret it. Yeah.
Thanks for that, Reese. Thanks. Really, really remarkable book. I'm glad, Patrick. Thank you again for being here. It's been a pleasure to have you.
And thanks for republishing this. Maybe I'll get some more readers in the first go around.
that's always the hope, right? That the readership increases rather than decreases over time.
Right.
That's exactly right. Thank you so much. And with that, we are the editors. This is the Advantes podcast, and we will see you next week.